Okay, so this is a joint presentation with Dave, and let me just briefly outline the talk. It'll be in two halves. I'll start by giving you an update on progress on the motion capture brain dynamics lab, and then Dave, I'll turn to our TDLC project, which has to do with brain dynamics and reward-based learning, which is with Scott and Terry. I will start just by giving you just some numbers. We currently have about 18 ongoing projects. I'm going to just tell you very briefly about maybe the last four or so. I just mentioned them. Gideon Diak is beginning to use the facility for monitoring brain and movement in toddlers during social interactions. Angela UNMO, eye movements and optimal control. We have a couple of new international projects. Carol Patton is studying the emergence of grammar in Bedouin sign language in Israel, and we recently captured some sign language movements so that she can present those there for studies of perception of movement and language. And last week, we had some world-class dancers in mocap from a dance company in London visiting David Kirsch in cognitive science. And we were asked to digitize some modern dance and create a visual, which is quite challenging from a motion capture point of view. But I want to show you just a brief clip of that in a sec. And then the second half of the first half of this talk, I want to update you on the ONR equipment grant that Gary mentioned. So most of the equipment now has arrived, and we're setting up a multimodal virtual environment that has not only visual but also auditory, touch, force, feedback. We also are combining motion capture and fMRI and EEG and fMRI. So those of you that saw Dong Pyo's poster last night, you can see our beginnings with grasping in a magnetic environment. Let me show you where science meets arts in capturing dance. So we did the full body recording, and we mapped the position of these diodes to a computer avatar, and the avatar is now animated with her movements. But of course, this is 3D quantitative data. So this was captured with our face-based system. I know. We need some hip-hop with it. But the choreographer of this dance company, who is actually the premier choreographer in England, was very impressed with the quality of the movement in the animation. And then turning just briefly to progress. I know. We're going to get to that. That's next. These are some pieces of equipment that we've either ordered or received. We have not received our head-mounted display, which will give us panoramic views in the virtual environment with eye tracking. We will have two of these so that we can have social interactions. We have received two haptic robots, which allow you to feel an object in the virtual environment. We do have an eye tracker and other equipment, which I'll describe. And then in terms of connecting up with fMRI, we do have a fiber optic fMRI glove, which we're beginning to use. We also, now in collaboration with Tom Liu, who's the director of the fMRI Center at UCSD, are collecting simultaneous EEG and fMRI data. And this is one slide from Tom. And you see that there are a lot of artifacts, actually, when you simultaneously record from both machines. He did some artifact reduction, and it looks like EEG afterwards. So this system works. Not that I know of.
How do you know that the system works? I mean, the fact that it looks like EEG seems. What do they have to do actually convince ourselves that it's actually working?
Well, we will, of course, be taking data with and without the MRI. And we'll be able to compare directly where we know what the known output should be. I should also mention that this equipment has been used as a springboard for another ONR grant that's pending. Hopefully ONR is still our friend, but recently with Terry and with Gary Lynch from UCI and with other TDLC and non-TDLC investigators, we submitted a $7.5 million grant to ONR to study unsupervised learning. From genetic to behavioral analysis using these techniques and virtual reality and others. Whoops. So just to give you a data flow of what the virtual and non-virtual environment will look like, I contracted out to a company called WorldViz that creates a virtual environment software platform called Vizard to do the integration. Just very briefly, this is our phase-based system. We are getting a new 20-camera phase space system that intermingles high-speed digital recording with these LED cameras. So our existing system will be available for short to medium-term loan out to labs that need it for 1 to 3 months. BioSemi, our eye tracker. This is just an orientation sensor for the head. Haptic robot, electromagnetics tracker. We do not yet have our auditory system, but it will have a 27-speaker auditory system that will allow presentation of auditory targets in various 3D locations. We have a cyber touch glove, a glove that measures joint angles and can present vibratory stimulation in the virtual environment. We don't have our two head-mounted displays yet. But they can be run simultaneously. Vizard has been used in cave environments, cluster environments, so these are completely synchronized. And, of course, in the virtual environment, you can manipulate the interaction to probe the underlying processes. You can create slow and fast worlds. You can alter the temporal constraints, and it's sort of up to the imagination. Vizard does receive timing pulses from an fMRI, so we can present virtual environments in the scanner. We spent a lot of time designing the synchronization. We can go through that. We just have the equipment delivered and the initial installation this week. So we'll be continuing to play with this for the next few months, and by the site visit time, everything should be ready. So now turning to our TDLC project, we started with simultaneous recording of EEG and movement, as Scott showed one of the initial slides there. Then in the second year, we turned to reward-based learning and modeling in normals and in dopamine-depleted Parkinson's patients. This past year, Dave's going to tell you about what we did in terms of simultaneous recording of EEG and movement during reward-based learning. And I should mention that what underlies all of these issues really is the functional roles of dopamine. We know that dopamine has many roles, including mediating aspects of reward processing and movement. So how can one molecule have such varied functions? Well, Wolfram Schultz, a dopamine guru, has recently put forward a rather provocative hypothesis that the varied functions of dopamine are coded by the time course of the dopamine response, And so he quotes, I'm quoting him from a recent annual review, "Dopamine is involved in mediating the reactivity of the organism to the environment at different time scales, from fast impulses related to reward, 60 to 100 millisecond latencies, The slower changes with uncertainty, punishment, and possibly movement, several hundred milliseconds, to the tonic enabling of postsynaptic motor, cognitive, and motivational systems deficient in Parkinson's disease, hormone-like timescales of minutes. And just very briefly before I turn it over to Dave, if we just look at the activity of a dopamine cell in response to a cue that predicts reward, we get a spike, a very phasic response, 60 to 100 milliseconds after that cue. And this codes what's called a reward prediction error, sort of a difference between what's expected and what's actually obtained in terms of reward. I don't have time to go through some of these intermediate functions, so I'm going to skip right to function number 5. It turns out that the history of the dopamine cell responses is important for decision-making and encoding decisions for future actions. And this, of course, is of a time scale from minutes to hours or even further. And in the experiment Dave's going to describe to you, it's really relevant to this reward prediction error coding and this decision function coding. Scott has a neighboring lab, which is another classroom in the basement of this annex, also very large, where he's setting up a very large-scale mobile brain imaging, where he sets up a permanent maze if he wants, and subjects actually walk around. That's his space. We've had such use of mocap that we've had scheduling bottlenecks, so this will really help free things up. We also have enough space for walking around in virtual environments. So,
Not at UCSD to actually loan the equipment.
I just briefly mentioned that. So, our existing face-based cameras. Will be loan out possible.
Around there, I'm actually going to focus on a different part of the story besides the dopamine story, which is the most well-developed story behind rewarded learning. There's a number of folks that have contributed to this. This is just a subset list. And here's a diagram where the background details that you probably can't read are meant to just illustrate the rich complexity of the networks and anatomy in the basal ganglia and other parts of the brain that interact with it. Of relevance for today's talk, so there's strong projections, as we all know, from dopamine systems in the midbrain primarily to not only various associative areas in cortex, but also many different structures in basal ganglia. And the take-home message that you want to keep in mind and that's often underappreciated is that there's an interaction between this dopamine system and the reentrant loops involving cortex, basal ganglia structures, and thalamus that are probably very functionally significant, and the oscillations that we measure with scalp EEG and other measures out at the cortex. Okay, so just a quick picture of what we're doing. Subjects are seated in front of a touch monitor. We're measuring their scalp EEG with the 64 electrode system and measuring their reaching movements with the face-based motion capture system we've got in MoCap. And I will tell you more about the paradigm here in a second. But it's a rewarded paradigm where on each trial the subject may or may not get a cash reward where we give them the accumulation at the end of the experiment. So there's on each trial you're only going to see a pair of images, but there's a set of 4 images that are used. We're picking just one, you know, random pair per each trial. And the important thing is that each one has a different probability of payoff. And we switch that halfway through the experiment. So there's a total of 512 trials, unbeknownst to the subject. And then here's the quick illustration of the trial timeline. Subjects initiate each trial by pressing this green go square, if you will, at the bottom center of the touch monitor. And then roughly almost a second later, the 2 images appear. And they're instructed to as soon as possible, choose one. And jittered 50 to 100 milliseconds thereafter, we give them an auditory signal indicating whether or not they got a reward on that trial. And an important point I should note is that the images are held up for between 6 to 800 milliseconds after their choice. So they're still there after that reward signal is presented. So in terms of the behavior, here's the learning curves. This green line, I don't know how well you can see that, illustrates the change point where the reward contingencies are reversed. And the one important take home here is that subjects come back to chance performance, actually slightly below chance, showing some perseveration right after the reversal, as you'd expect, but quickly thereafter adapt to the new reward contingencies.
What's the optimum performance?
I don't know. Honestly, that's something, an obvious, simple question we haven't looked at yet. I'll get to the modeling piece of it, and we could simulate it with a computer playing the game. So there's kind of three components to our research. There's the behavior, naturally, the physiology with the EEG, but also the computational modeling piece. Well, why are we doing the modeling piece? An important point to remember is that, yeah, we could fit a model to any data, but an important thing we're trying to do here is infer internal variables that are not externally accessible through standard behavioral measures like responses. We're trying to infer what is really driving this rewarded learning process. And so one of the important things that modeling can help us do here is try to infer these putative internal signals that are driving that learning process. And what we'll talk about here is the reward prediction error. And the modeling endeavor provides us with that prediction error on a trial-by-trial basis. And the question is, how does that relate to the brain dynamics, in our case, the brain oscillations that we're looking at with EEG? Okay, so the modeling piece, just a couple simple equations. This is a very simple reinforcement learning model that we've used where the prediction error, let me walk through this. Q is just your valuation for one of the four images at time t, trial t. And we're updating it on each trial based on the discrepancy between what you expected and what you got. So the reward here is 0 or 1. The Q values vary between 0 and 1 in a continuous fashion. And epsilon here is just the learning rate parameter that weights that discrepancy in updating the Q value from one trial to the next. Very simple. And the way that the model suggests which action would be selected is done probabilistically with a softmax function. So this is a sigmoid where the slope of the sigmoid is determined by a tau parameter here. So if you look at extreme cases, if tau is 0, this expression comes down to 1/2, right? And we're just choosing randomly. We're exploring. We're not exploiting any knowledge we might have about the world. As tau is increased, then you're more likely to choose the more favorable image, whether it's image K or M. Does that make sense? Okay, so another important thing to keep in mind is that we don't fit the model to the grand average behavior, like the curve I showed you. We fit it to each individual subject's data on a trial-by-trial basis. The reason why that's important, for, among other things, is that different subjects' learning profiles look different, so the best model to fit their data looks different, right? And this is just an illustration for one subject where here this is increasing learning rate and increasing tau, where for this subject, for example, a relatively low learning rate and a relatively high tau, which correlates to exploitation or exploiting your knowledge, was the best fit for their behavioral profile. Okay, now let's get to the physiology. So fortunately, Scott gave you some background on ICA and its use with EEG. This is an example of one independent component from one subject in our study where here's the scalp topography of that independent component. So the relative weightings of that component back to the native scalp electrodes, where it has obviously a more predominant frontal projection. And here's where that dipole maps to. And procedurally, what we did was there's accumulating evidence that these reward mechanisms involve ventromedial prefrontal cortical areas and some orbitofrontal cortical areas. So in our initial analysis, we just constrained our investigation to independent components that had dipoles that had low residual variance. In other words, where the data was well accounted for by that single equivalent current dipole in the brain, and dipoles that localized to those two rough regions. So here's one example where probably in an almost identical location to the dipole that Scott was showing earlier, it's probably an anterior cingulate cortex. So what happens to the activity that's thought to derive from that dipole in response to these reward signals? So let me explain these plots. So each one, time is on the x-axis here. I apologize for the labels are small. This is roughly the 1 second after the reward signal. Frequency is on the y-axis, going from 4 to roughly 25 hertz. So we're just looking at theta, alpha, and beta here. And on the left subplot here is the average spectral dynamics from all the trials where you won. In other words, where the prediction error is positive. And conversely, in the trials where you didn't win, here's the average spectrogram for this component across all those trials, and here's the difference. And the take-home here is that, I don't know if you can see that one, there's a strong relative desynchronization in theta and alpha frequency bands in a time window 3 to 500 milliseconds, roughly, post-reward signal. But a big question we're wondering is, we've got from the model the prediction error estimated on a trial-by-trial basis. Can we, on a single trial basis, relate the dynamics in this scalp EEG to that prediction error, which is putatively driving the learning? And so these are scatter plots of all 512 trials. Each point is a trial, where the x-axis is the prediction error between negative 1 and 1. And the y-axis here is the change in power in each of those respective frequency bands. The correlations here are very low, as you can see. They're statistically significant. To give you a sense of how widespread this was across our subjects, the past few slides have just been this one example subject. Out of our 13 subjects, 11 of them exhibited dipoles with low residual variance that located in either VMPFC or orbitofrontal cortex. The majority of those did exhibit these effects where alpha and theta showed desynchronization with respect to prediction error. So it looks like a fairly robust effect. But one question is, well, is this a general widespread thing and it happens to show up where we looked, but it's everywhere in the brain? And so what if you look in, for example, posterior parietal cortex? And if you look at, here's an example from the same subject, there were 5 dipoles that roughly localized to that area of the brain. And they appear to exhibit, with one exception here, the opposite effect, where you see relative synchronization corresponding with prediction error. And it seems primarily dominant in high alpha frequency ranges. So it suggests that, A, it might be involved in this process, but it might have a different involvement in terms of the spectral dynamics in that part of the brain. So that's where that's at. Here's the quick summary of where we're at. I think the important thing to remember is that we're trying to relate these internal reward signals that are putatively driving the learning with the trial-by-trial dynamics of the brain. And the early evidence suggests that we could do that, and that the relative desynchronization in these theta and alpha frequency bands and frontal sources appears to be a key signature of that learning. And a couple next steps, we're going to focus a little bit more on what's the spatial selectivity of this effect. And a very exciting thing we're gearing up to do is over 30,000 Parkinson's patients in this country have had chronically implanted electrodes put primarily either in their bilaterally in the subthalamic nucleus or globus pallidus, so key basal ganglia brain structures, where they're being chronically stimulated with very high frequency, typically on the order of 180 hertz stimuli, on the order of a couple volts, 2, 3, 4, 5 volts. And in these patients, we've done a couple of pilot patients, but we're gearing up to run a whole study on these patients. And the question is, in this case where you've got neuromodulation electrophysiologically in awake, alive human brain, how does that influence these dynamics and correspondingly the learning involved and using these dynamics? Again, there's several people that have helped out with this. Terry's been instrumental with the modeling piece. I've got a couple fantastic undergraduate assistants that have really helped out with the turning the crank on the research. Many people in Scott's lab, Eric Hallgren at the Multimodal Imaging Laboratory, and of course our participants. Any questions?
Yeah, it should be interesting to try a more data-driven approach in the last stage to decide to extract the spectral patterns associated with the error signals.
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead, Tom.
I had a question about the procedure. So this is a two alternative force choice experiment. So people can vary on how they use the information and learn about the information that's appropriate to maximize their reward. Mm-hmm. People can also vary in whether they respond quickly, whether they respond slowly. Mm-hmm. Roger Ratcliffe and others have shown that even things like age-related differences may not be related to the quality of the information, but how conservative or liberal, that older people are just more conservative and they respond slower, not because they're overall slow, but that they are more conservative in their responses. So have you considered looking at say, using these learning models to drive something that might actually account for the time to make a response, and looking at that as another covariate across individuals.
That's an excellent suggestion. So the question, I don't know if you could hear, is could we relate, for example, some of the temporal aspects of the time it takes to make the choice to other aspects of the experiment through a modeling endeavor? And a couple comments on that. First, we, in the course of looking at our Parkinson's patients before, we looked at their age-matched controls. And in both groups, of course, relative to the young controls, who these were, you see slower movements. And oftentimes, it appears to be a little bit more in the way of deliberation in their choices, despite the instruction to make your choice immediately. And in terms of how we could relate that to the modeling piece, and a very exciting possibility is, okay, if you look at their current, what the model says, the two image estimate or value estimations, Q, K, and M, that you're faced with, if there's a high degree of uncertainty there, you'd think that might translate to a slower response intuitively. And that's something we could readily look at and haven't yet. Yeah.
And there's ways of taking these models of kind of how you interpret the information and using them to kind of drive a decision process that has variability in terms of the criteria to make a response. So there's ways you can do that.
Yeah. Another comment I want to add, this is just my quick, I'm going to steal 30 seconds here for pie in the sky. So leaving the science for a minute and speculation, one of the things I think might really be important here, and there's a lot of evidence that needs to be hammered out, is if these scalp measurable oscillations tell us something about the learning process, and if we can do that on a trial-by-trial basis, maybe we could use that information so that if people are in a learning environment, we might be able to titrate the information they're given, or even small changes in the timing. If it depends on where the information onset occurs relative to the phase of a certain oscillation, for example, well, maybe it would make a difference in how well they're going to encode it if we slide it up 10 milliseconds or make it 30 milliseconds later. So that's pie in the sky, and it's probably 10 years out, but a thought I wanted to plant in your mind. Thanks.